we're going to hear Senate Bill 74.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 74 exempts statute requiring insurance coverage of certain metabolic disorders from automatic repeal provisions. You have a dash one amendment that adds an emergency clause and also removes that automatic repeal provision language and repeals this part of statute on January 2nd of 2009. And this bill is dealing with PKU. You might be familiar with that.
Senator Courtney, would you step to the microphone, please, and identify yourself for those of us who don't know who you are?
I will.
Chair Morissette, Senator Minister Shields, Senator Starr, and Committee Administrator Marty Taylor. My name is Peter Courtney, and I live at 2925 Island View Drive here in Salem, and I'm a state senator that represents District 11. There's two testimonies. I've handed out one, which is my official testimony, which is before you, but that's because the person sitting to my right who helped pioneer this legislation with me back in the 1997 session corrected all my testimony and felt this was better. But I'm not going to read that. I'm going to speak from my original testimony because I just feel more comfortable with my original testimony than the official scientific testimony that's in front of you. And I'm only going to say this once because I can't pronounce it more than once. Phenylketonuria, PKU, is a dietary deficiency in newborn children. A special diet called formula will allow the child to live a normal life. But without such a formula, over time the child will suffer mental damage. Eventually the child could become a total dependent, unable to care for themselves. Up until 1997, insurance companies were not required to cover the cost of the formula. Some did and some didn't. In the 97 legislative session, the PKU bill, as it was called, House Bill 2388, was introduced. This measure required insurance companies to cover the special PKU diet formula. The legislation also included a six-year sunset clause. House Bill 2388 became law on July 3, 1997. The six-year sunset period will toll on July 3, 2003 of this year. Today, Senate Bill 74 is before you to extend the PKU formula beyond the deadline of July of this year. In effect, to place with the amendments another six-year sunset is what this is all about. The bill remains the same. We're talking about changing the sunset and extending it another 6 years. House Bill 2388 originally passed because of little Katie. She's here today. She was the star witness for this measure. Other children also came forward to testify. Parents and others also showed support. The legislation overwhelmingly passed both chambers and was signed by the governor. Today, Katie is back, and she will be joined by a strong team of parents, nurses, and others. Okay. We have had 6 years to see how House Bill 2388 worked. The results are in, and I think you will like them. Please pass Senate Bill 74. It was a good idea in 1997, and it's a good idea today. That is the statement I have and comments I have to make to the committee at this time. I believe you have before you another official statement from me, which is more technical in terms of what it's all about. Also, I'm joined with Connie Seeley, who at that time was my legislative assistant, L.A. Today, of course, she is my chief of staff. And as all of us know, we're only as good as our staff. Probably she deserves more credit than I do. In fact, I know she does for getting House Bill 2388 passed way back in 1997. Plus, she's a healthcare expert. I am not. She can pronounce such things as what PKU are, as well as all of the other type of diseases that this bill would be affected by. So, Mr. Chair, thank you very much for allowing me to even come here today and speak on Senate Bill 74. And please, I also thank you for holding a public hearing on this measure.
Thank you. Senator Minnis.
Mr. President, the amendments to the bill, or the bill itself, provides an additional sunset in 6 years?
That's correct. Chair Morissette, Senator Minnis, that is correct. That is what the amendments do, it's my understanding. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. the question then is why? If the mandate is working, why would we want to revisit it 6 years from now?
Chair Morris said, Senator Menendez, because the insurance industries will stop the bill from going through.
Really?
But at least they'll oppose the bill, let's put it that way. That's what's involved. You asked the question, Senator Menendez. You've served with me for many years. You know, I just be very upfront with it. They'll oppose the bill. And I don't want to take a chance, Senator Menendez.
Do you have any official record or statement saying that the insurance industry will oppose it?
Only that they've advised me that if the sunset was on individually, that they wouldn't oppose the bill. That's all I have.
Hmm. Well, I'm not opposed to making them angry.
Senator Menendez, I didn't. I'm just doing the best I can to keep a bill, keep a piece of legislation alive, which I think has been pretty good. That's all. I'm just trying.
All right.
I took the safe way or the easy way, whatever you want to say, Senator Menendez. I took that approach on this measure.
Thank you. Connie? Oh, you're not going to testify.
No.
Could you pronounce all the words that people pronounce?
I'll let the experts do that, Senator.
Okay. Thank you.
Very much.
Thank you. I'd like to just say in general that we're going to try to get through this in the next 45 minutes, and we have a number of people to testify, so keep that in mind as you testify. So Kathleen Huntington, Dr. Carrie Harding, and Dr. Michael Skies.
Skills.
Well, S-K-E-E-L. Skills. Dr. Michael Skills.
Michael. Just call him Mike.
Dr. Mike.
Dr. Mike. That sounds good.
How about,
you do a talk show?
How about Mikey?
No.
Mike.
You better not call it the chief health officer in the state, Mikey.
Dr. Skills. Kathleen, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes. Is this on?
Yes.
Senator Morissette and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Kathleen Huntington. I'm a dietitian, a clinical dietitian at Oregon Health Sciences Metabolic Clinic, also Dornbecker. And I've been in this position working with patients in this clinic for 16 years. And what I'm going to talk to you today about are a couple of things to give you background information as to why the passage of this bill is so compelling. I'm asking you to support House Bill 74 because it equalizes access to medical treatment for all socioeconomic groups, patient groups. It increases the potential for optimal outcome because it enhances the adherence to therapy recommendations for the treatment of these disorders. And it saves Oregon a lot of money in terms of special education costs and health care costs. So the questions I'm going to cover are, what is a genetic metabolic disorder? Why are medical foods needed to treat these disorders? And why is legislation needed to mandate coverage of medical foods? Well, background information. Basically, human beings have 46 chromosomes in the nucleus of their cells. On those chromosomes are genes that code for the blueprints for proteins. And there's a lot of different functions for proteins in the human body. One of them is enzymes. Enzymes convert compounds into other metabolites into other compounds. With genetic disorders, they are caused by the mutations in the genes, which change the enzymatic action so that metabolic pathways are interfered with. The common function of them is interfered with. Metabolism is basically dealing with breaking things down and building things up, making energy. And so metabolic inborn errors of metabolism interfere with this process. normally, in normal metabolism, you get a substrate with an enzyme converting it to a product. But with an inborn error metabolism, you get a block with that enzyme because it's not functioning, and you get a buildup of the substrate and other metabolites, which cause problems. Think of this as a bridge that breaks down, galloping girding. And what happens at the other end is a huge traffic jam. Lots of problems, bumper-to-bumper traffic, fender benders, etc. Chaos and severe damage. Metabolic disorders cause a lot of health problems. They include mental retardation, muscle weakness, coma, brain damage, and death in some cases. Medical foods are used to treat these inborn errors in metabolism. In the 1970s, the FDA decided to deregulate medical foods so that they wouldn't be counted as pharmaceuticals. This supposedly helped with the research and development of these products, but it created a lot of problems. This is where our problems started for our patients. When they stopped being regulated as pharmaceuticals, the insurance companies decided they weren't going to cover treatment. The FDA created a new statement or description of medical foods in 1998 in the Orphan Drug Act, which states that they are to be used under medical food supervision and administered for the specific treatment of certain diseases. Because they're used to treat very rare disorders, medical foods are very expensive. For example, if you were to buy regular infant formula, it would be $14 for a 400-gram can, which is about 13 and a half ounces. The same size unit for medical beverage formula costs $19 to $35 per can, plus shipping and handling. Another example is 1 pound of white rice cost 85 cents at Fred Meyer's. I went out and checked 2 weekends ago. It was on sale. 1 pound of low-profile rice, though, cost $7.40 plus shipping and handling. You can see automatically why this is going to be a financial burden on many families. So let's zero in on a specific disorder, which is phenylketonuria, also known as PKU. It's diagnosed in newborns via newborn screening, treated with protein-restricted diet and medical foods, and the untreated clinical complication is mental retardation. It's passed on through two carrier parents, and there's 1 in 4 chance if those parents are carriers that the child will have PKU. Let's look at the specific requirements of a medical nutritional therapy for PKU. Let's take an 8-year-old child. That child needs 28 grams of protein to grow normally and 1,900 calories each day. Typical American diets, the children eat at this age 3 times to 4 times that amount of protein in the regular diet. But if a child with PKU, they typically can only tolerate 5 grams of natural protein each day in order to keep the phenylalanine low enough so it won't cause mental retardation. So what does 5 grams of protein look like? It's 2 tablespoons of cooked spaghetti, 1/3 cup tomato sauce, 1/4 cup of cooked broccoli, 1/3 slice of bread, 1/2 cup tossed lettuce, and 3/4 of a fresh orange. If any of you have children, you know that this is not going to satisfy even a 1 and a half year old child in terms of their basic needs. It only provides 165 calories. So the medical foods provide the balance of calories that the child needs to grow normally and develop. Medical foods are not supplemental. The natural foods are supplemental. They're the recreational part of their diet. The medical foods sustain them so that they'll grow normally. They have to combine their intake with a medical protein source and low protein substitute products, which are like pasta, baking mix, crackers, all these things that are specially made for these kinds of diets. If you look at what it costs the state to not treat PKU, just look at your average special education cost per year in Oregon right now. Average is $6,300 per child. When the individual reaches adulthood and their families can no longer take care of them and they require supervised care in a nursing facility, it costs $3,000 to $5,000 per month to take care of these individuals. Medical food costs are far less, and they do not cost the state anything because if they're covered by insurance, the insurance helps pay for these medical costs. Typically, they run from about $2,000 for an infant up to $10,000 for a young teen or adult. If you were to look for the cost comparison for up to a lifespan of 30 years, for someone who's not treated, it'll cost about $100,800 for special education costs, and then between 10 and 20 years, if the person were to be placed in a supervised care residential care center, it would cost another $480,000, and that's what it would cost the state for the first 30 years of this individual's life. And people with metabolic disorders live a full, long-range life of 65, 75 years of age. Whereas the estimated cost for an individual who is treated would cost up to $217,000. This poor person was never treated for PKU. He does not have a future. He has no potential. He cannot even figure out how to open a door using a doorknob. These two people, on the other hand, have a great amount of potential. This little guy just came into clinic yesterday. He's saying his first words. He's saying please. He's a year and a half. He's starting to do all the things that you would expect a one-and-a-half-year-old child to do. Mark is another young man who is just graduated from high school and is going to college down in California. This is his quote. Treatment with medical food opens the gates of knowledge that otherwise would be locked. Medical foods are absolutely necessary for these individuals. The new Born Screening program has expanded their review of different kinds of disorders and now are screening for 26 metabolic disorders. If the state is going to support this, then I think it would behoove the state to make sure that coverage for the treatment is provided for. So I ask you please to support Senate Bill 74. Yes, sir.
Thank you for your testimony. How many states have this coverage?
The last count up to about 35 states have passed laws mandating coverage for medical food.
Okay.
Oregon has actually one of the best laws and it has been used as a template for other legislation efforts.
Okay. And this is a lifelong treatment.
This is a lifelong treatment because these are genetic disorders.
And the figure that you had for coverage and not coverage, treatment or not treatment, the comparison, is that $580,000? Is that for how? Is that a 30-year?
No, up just to 30 years.
30 years. Up to 30. Okay. Yes. Senator Shields.
This is maybe an off-the-wall question, but what happens if somebody is in this treatment plan on this diet, say, for 25 years, and then for some reason is taken off this diet or goes off this diet? I mean, at that point, they have grown and they have gotten an education and so on. Is there a reversal of some sort?
Yes, there is, and that's why it makes it so compelling to have diet therapy for life. We've actually seen some individuals in clinic this last week who did go off diet in their teenage years and now have come back to clinic because they're noticing some very measurable health complications, tremors and difficulty concentrating and depression are the hallmarks of untreated PKU as an adult.
There isn't follow-up?
Yes.
There isn't some sort of retardation kind of thing it sets in?
No, they don't lose.
Okay.
They can use a little bit of intelligence quotient, but it would be hard to measure. It's more of a we're having to do with concentration and ability to organize thought.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Dr. Harding?
Thank you, Senator Morrison. I'm Dr. Kerry Harding. I'm assistant professor of pediatrics at OHSU, and I work with Kathleen in the metabolic clinic. I don't have much to add to her presentation. I have submitted my official testimony. I simply wanted to give a small personal experience in that last week when Kathleen and I were in clinic in Eugene, we saw one of our clients who was born before we had newborn screening and before we had treatment, and this client of ours is 46 years old and is severely mentally retarded, has been a ward of the state basically from very early in life, was an inpatient at Fairview for many years, seizes continuously, has virtually no speech and no social interaction, and that's what obviously happens if you've never had therapy. I want to follow up on your question, Dr. Shields, though, about adults who have gone off diet. The study's never actually been very carefully done to, say, measure IQs to see what happens to them, but I can tell you from a wealth of experience that they have tremendous cognitive problems and great difficulty maintaining employment because they can't follow instructions, they can't maintain their attention. They start having motor difficulties that doesn't allow them to do fine motor skills, and it can be a huge, huge issue for them. The only other thing that I wanted to add is that this is basically standard of care pretty much worldwide, at least in civilized countries that have the resources to do this. There are, as Kathleen mentioned, 35 states with laws on the book, but there are several states that actually provide this therapy and the medical foods as a treatment. There is no insurance coverage. The state pays for the therapy, and that is true worldwide elsewhere in Canada and Europe. So I strongly urge you to support the passage of the bill.
One other question, I guess. I'm sorry, Senator Minnis isn't in the room at the moment, but he might be asking the question, how many of those things you just referenced go through this thing with a revolving sunset?
I'm not sure about the states that have a insurance mandate. I can tell you from personal experience, since I trained mostly in the Midwest, most of the states, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, in their initial newborn screening law that was established years ago, it was set aside funds to pay for the treatment, and basically they've never had to revisit that issue. I'm not sure about the states that have insurance mandates. Do you?
No.
Certainly
no.
That would be an interesting thing to know.
Well, I guess, thank you. And my question is, if a person leaves the state and goes somewhere else, they have to register in that program, probably showing background information and so on to verify. And I'm assuming that if a person comes to the state of Oregon with that condition, they then are covered by the insurance.
If they have a job with insurance.
They have a job with insurance, okay. So it's conceivable that a person coming to the state of Oregon would not be eligible for, obviously, for the benefits set. Okay. As opposed to the states that you mentioned, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The state provides the program.
I mean, there are multiple ways to skin the cat, obviously. The way it was done in Wisconsin was the fee that was charged to do the newborn screening included a surcharge that then built up a fund to pay for the medical food. So once the diagnosis was provided, there was a fund from which we bought those foods and distributed them to the families under our prescription.
Interesting. Good. Thank you, Dr. Steele.
Thanks. Chairman Morissette, members of the committee, I'm Mike Skeels. I'm director of the State Public Health Laboratory in the Department of Human Services. Our department strongly supports Senate Bill 74. It's really vital that children that we identify through newborn screening receive the full range of treatment, medical care, including medical foods and all the other things that they need to prevent severe brain damage or death. I'll just add a couple of things. These disorders are inapparent at birth. The children look fine, they seem healthy, and it's possible, therefore, to identify them through screening of their blood and begin the treatment before they ever become ill, before they ever develop the symptoms of the disease, and that's a very important point. In 1962, Oregon became the very first state in the United States to begin statewide screening for PKU. And excuse me, prior to our implementing universal screening, 1% of all the admissions to Fairview were because of untreated, undiagnosed PKU. And after we started screening, there was never another such admission in the entire history of Fairview. So we're very proud of that, and this has been a really effective program. As both Kathleen and Dr. Harding said, the treatment involves specialized dietary monitoring and ongoing relationship with the child and their family to make sure that they get the clinical supervision that they need. And our laboratory also participates in that by testing these kids to make sure that they're staying on their diet and that they're not having problems. I'll just also say that in the past 40 years since we started PKU screening, we've worked in close partnership with the Oregon Health and Science University. And we have a really model system where we identify children who have these disorders. We get medical consultation, nutritional consultation from OHSU. They work with the baby's doctors. They refer them to specialty clinics. They're seen by specialty physicians like Dr. Harding and others and nurses. The families work with Kathleen to do what they need to control the diet. They share recipes. It's really a wonderful system. It's as close to a seamless delivery system as you're going to find. We've screened 1.5 million Oregon infants so far since we started, and we've identified over 600 disorders, and I don't think we've missed one yet, knock wood, but I don't think we've had a single miss as a result of a baby not being screened in our laboratory. I'll just close by saying that there's really little use in our program detecting these disorders at birth if we can't assure that the infants are going to get the treatment they need. So we encourage you to pass Senate Bill 74. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Question, Mr.
Yes. Senator Walker.
Who prepared this document?
No, report required by ORS.
What is it?
The report.
Oh. I did.
Did you prepare that? This is an excellent document. Okay. I've been looking at it. It's very clear about what you've done, what needs to be done, what you've accomplished. This is really what I like to see when people come and testify. And there was something else that I read here from Dr. Skeels, actually, where you said you've screened 1.5 million Oregon infants and identified over 600 with metabolic disorders in need of treatment. Today, we are screening all Oregon babies for 26 disorders, including PKU, all with a few drops of blood. Can you, are some of those other disorders covered by insurance? And
Chairman Morissette and Senator Walker, yes, not all of these disorders are treated through diet, but several of them are. And we were able to expand our screening as a result of House Bill 2268, which passed in the last legislative session. And so in addition to the six disorders that we were screening for, which included PKU, we can now screen for a whole variety of metabolic disorders. And Dr. Harding knows more about the treatment of those than I do. You want to comment?
Senator Morissette and Senator Walker, the PKU is by far and away the most common disorder of the battery that we diagnose. The others are individually rare, although in total the incidence is probably about 1 out of 4,000 births, so we in general get about 10 or 12 babies a year with something, and probably 8 of those have a dietary therapy that we would be instituting. Others might be classic medication type of. In every case, they are disorders that we have a very high likelihood of making a substantial improvement in their outcome by treating them before they become symptomatic.
I've just been impressed. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just comment, my children were born at home. They're 23 and 24 now, a long time ago, but I remember the heel prick and the blood and the PKU test, but never really understood what it all meant. So I appreciate that you've brought this information, and so many people are in the audience today, I suspect, who are people who have had experience with this, and I just want to thank you today.
What's the time period between birth and when the onset of the disorder?
Senator Morissette, it varies depending on the disorder. In the case of PKU, you begin to see definite developmental issues by a month of life, and we strive to start treatment no later than the second week, even faster if we can.
Good. Thank you. Tim Cleish and Caitlin, would you come up, please?
Chairman Morissette and Senators, my name is Katie Kelsch. I am 10 years old and I PKU. I am here to ask you to support the renewal of the Medical Foods Law, also known as Senate Bill 74. Oregon has a law that requires that all babies be tested for PKU at birth. As a result of that law, I was diagnosed and placed on a very strict diet and special formula that saved my life. If I was both undiagnosed and treated, I would today be very retarded and able to attend school or do anything a normal 10-year-old can do. It would cost insurance companies a whole lot more to take care of me like that than to cover my medical foods and formulas that make me healthy today. When I was little, most insurance companies covered the special formula that I needed, but one day back in 1995, when my mom changed her jobs, a new company. That's one reason why we asked you to pass the law in 1997. Today, because the law expired, I am asking you to help us pass this law again. Have any of you ever had to be on a strict diet? It's not very fun, is it? My strict diet is required for life. My strict diet requires that I never eat meat, cheese, or dairy of any kind. That means when my friends are eating cheeseburgers, ice cream, and pizza, I'm eating vegetables and salads. Activities as simple as slumber parties, birthday parties, and school field trips require that I carefully pre-plan what I will be able to eat. My parents send a blood test to the state medical laboratory every other week to make sure that I'm managing my diet properly. I'll be honest, managing this diet is very difficult. I don't know how I could stick to it if I didn't have at least a couple of medical food choices that I can eat with my formula. Did you know that more than 30 states have passed laws that require insurance companies to cover the cost of medical foods that treat PKU? Please help me and other people like me stay on this difficult diet by passing Senate Bill 74. Thank you.
Thank you, Caitlin. Tim?
Good job.
Good job.
Chairman Morissette and committee members, my name is Tim Kelsch. My wife Cheryl and I, along with our daughter Katie and son James, reside at 1370 Rafael Street in Kaiser. I am here today with my family to gain your support for Senate Bill 74 that renews the medical foods law that was passed in 1997. The problems that we encountered securing insurance coverage for Caitlin, who has phenylketonuria, or PKU, are why we're here today. Caitlin is one of approximately two or three people born each year in the state of Oregon with this inherited metabolic disorder. Katie's liver cannot break down phenylalanine, one of the 20 amino acids that make up protein and is commonly found in most foods. Left unchecked, phenylalanine would accumulate in the brain, and the little girl you see sitting here would be profoundly retarded. However, thanks to mandatory newborn screening in Oregon, Katie's disorder was detected at birth, and her condition has been entirely controlled. This control is made possible with a protein-restricted diet that includes the use of specific medical foods created to treat this disorder. Without these medical foods, Caitlin would not be the normal 10-year-old that she is today. In July of 1995, a larger company acquired my wife's employer. we were aware that our insurance carrier was changing from Blue Cross to MetroHealth. Blue Cross had, since birth, covered Katie's treatment under the standard terms of her group health insurance policy without incident. OHSU, who provided treatment for Katie's condition, suggested that we should verify our coverage with the new provider. To assist us, they provided a letter from our physician explaining the medical necessity of the treatment of PKU with medical foods and formula. Later in July, we received verbal confirmation that MetroHealth had approved the letter of medical necessity and would, like Blue Cross, cover her treatment under the terms of our group insurance. We were relieved, to say the least. We had subsequently learned of other families in Oregon who were struggling with their insurance companies over the treatment of PKU. We didn't think we were one of them. Our relief was short-lived when we discovered that our medical claims were going unpaid. Cheryl called MetroHealth on February 28th of 1996, 7 months after we had received approval, yet not a single claim had been paid. We were floored when a customer service representative for the company advised us that there was no record of the approval of Katie's treatment and that the letter of medical necessity from OHSU had mysteriously disappeared. Thus began a 9-month ordeal of letters, phone calls, faxes, and appeals. Armed with detailed documentation of her conversations with the MetroHealth representative from July of 1995 and with copies of the letter of medical necessity, Cheryl was able to get MetroHealth to admit that they had verbally committed to coverage. They agreed to cover the cost of her medically necessary foods claimed between July of 1995 and February of 1996. However, they would not cover her after that point. They stated that their medical director had determined that contrary to worldwide standards of treatment for PKU and a letter from our physician, that Katie did not need treatment. We were outraged at their ignorance. Didn't they realize that without treatment our daughter would be retarded? We could not let this kind of gross incompetence prevail. Cheryl began appeal number two, at which time Cheryl and I agreed that the only permanent solution to the nightmare we were going through was to seek legislation that would protect our family and other families from the arbitrary denial of insurance benefits based on the ignorance of a minority of insurance companies. We knew, based on talking to other PKU parents and medical providers at OHSU, that most large health insurance carriers in Oregon recognize the medical necessity of the treatment of PKU with medical foods and formulas. It was therefore our intent to bring a minority of carriers up to the standard of care that the larger providers recognized. Cheryl continued the appeal process while we worked in tandem with Representative Courtney. Armed with yet another letter from our physician at OHSU, we embarked on appeal number three with MetroHealth. 2.5 months after we started our third appeal, we received the answer we had waited for. They determined that the treatment of PKU with medical foods was indeed medically necessary, and they would cover these medical foods based on the provisions of our company policy. It took almost a year of letters, phone calls, and countless hours of determination, but we finally won our appeal. We agreed that we could not let another family go through such a long and frustrating process and would continue to seek a permanent solution through the legislative process. During the 1997 legislative session, we, along with the support of many other parents, medical providers, and legislators, introduced House Bill 2388, the original medical foods bill. We are pleased to tell you that this bill passed both the House and Senate unanimously. Several of you participated in the successful passage of that bill, and we thank you. Today, however, the sunset clause has necessitated us to ask you to please renew this important piece of legislation. Prior to 1997, only 14 other states had similar legislation. Today, more than 30 states have passed this legislation, many using the Oregon bill as their model. Our goal in 1997 was, and is today, to ensure that other families afflicted with PKU or similarly threatening metabolic disorders would never be rejected by their group or individual health insurance carriers again. As previously stated, the major insurance carriers in the state of Oregon prior to the 1997 legislation did provide coverage for medical foods for the treatment of PKU. The medical foods bill, when passed, made sure that all insurance carriers provided the same level of treatment for PKU and other rare inborn errors of metabolism. The renewal of the medical foods law through Senate Bill 74 will allow a uniform standard of care to continue by all providers. As you can see, Katie is normal, beautiful, and a bright child because of her treatment since birth with medical foods. Passage of Senate Bill 74 will continue to ensure that Katie and others like her have an equal chance to grow up as normal, productive, and contributing members of society. thanks for your support. There is one other issue that I would like to touch on, if you don't mind. It's especially critical for females to stay on diet. The reason is that if they were to go off diet for any reason and become pregnant during that time, there's a significant risk of in utero retardation for the baby. So, it's a serious issue for particularly females, in addition to the obvious things that we've already talked about today. So, again, we would thank you for your support.
Good, thank you. So, Katie, you're 10 years old, right? Ten? How old are you,
you're
Katie?
10 years old, right?
Yeah, okay. And what school do you go to?
Forest Ridge Elementary.
Okay, good. I have a granddaughter named Caitlin who looks a lot like you. She's kind of goofy like you are. No, I say that in a very positive way. She's a sweet little girl, has a great smile. And are you going to be back in 6 years, if need be, to testify again? And
yeah.
You were, okay, and I'm sure you were here 6 years ago, right, when you were 4 years old. Okay.
And she testified.
And you testified, and so this is something that you have to continue doing. So I would hope that we could pass it without the sunset, but I'm not sure that we're going to be able to do that. So rather than take the chance, I guess we will go along with that, but hopefully we will accomplish that. So thank you very much for being here. Thanks, Katie.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, just
yes.
A moment. I just wanted to let Katie know, my daughter's a vegetarian, and she would tell you that you're not missing much by not eating hamburgers. So that's okay. I understand some of those foods probably aren't as good, but trust me, you'll grow up to be a beautiful girl, as you already are. Thank you.
Senator Fisher has a question.
I was just curious. I recall the legislation we did in 97, but I don't recall the, and I'm sure there probably was testimony as to the costs of the food. What is the process? Do you know what the process is to create, for instance, take this phenylalanine or whatever it is out of the rice and that kind of thing?
Okay. I don't. That is a an engineered food product. I know that with respect to her powdered formula, what they do is they create a synthetic protein which has the other 19 amino acids in it minus the phenylalanine, and that gives her the basic protein components that she needs to grow and develop normally. So we mix the formula with water each day, and she drinks that. And there's been a lot of talk today about the costs, the economic benefits of the legislation, and those are very real, I believe. But to give you an idea of kind of where we come from as typical people, our insurance coverage kicks in after the initial $500 deductible for each person on the policy, and then it pays typically about 80% of the cost. So we still have a substantial cost. With the medical foods and the formula, it's just that the insurance, you know, helps make it workable, obviously, for us.
I was just curious as to the process, and I guess there again, a fairly small amount considering how many people are involved there with that would certainly not be a volume product, but. Be as much as nearly 10 times the price seemed a little bit steep, unless it was a huge process that they went through and a hugely expensive substitute.
Well, that's probably true, and I would suspect that part of the reason for that higher cost is simply the fact that the volume just isn't there for those medical foods manufacturers. But perhaps someone from OHSU like Kathleen could speak more intelligently on that particular process than I could.
Okay. Hang in there, Caitlin.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye, Katie. Okay, we have six more people sign up to speak. We don't have anyone in opposition, so we do have another bill that will take probably almost an hour. So, Joanne Rogovi? Oh.
Good try.
Okay, well, I should have spoken to you on the way down in the elevator. We probably could have. Caroline Brenneman, would you come up, please? And Jennifer Jones, would you come up, please? If you would introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Joanne Rogovoy, and I am the State Director of Program Services for the March of Dimes. I'm here today on behalf of the March of Dimes to ask your support of Senate Bill 74. The mission of the March of Dimes is to improve the health of mothers and babies by preventing birth defects and infant mortality. Our organization funded much of the research that resulted in the development of the original newborn screening techniques. Oregon screens for 26 disorders at birth, and most of these are metabolic birth defects. Some of these, such as PKU, are treatable with medical foods like we've talked about with the other presenters. And the important thing is if left untreated, it causes irreversible mental retardation. Again, I don't want to repeat what everyone else said. I just want to reaffirm and let you know that the March of Dimes supports Senate Bill 74, and we ask that you support Senate Bill 74. And I would like to thank you for letting me testify in support of this bill on behalf of the March of Dimes.
Thank you. If you would, yeah.
Chairman Morrison, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2388 or Senate Bill 74. My name is Caroline Brenneman, and I am the very proud mother of 19-year-old Mark Brenneman, who was featured in the literature we received, and he was the handsome boy in the cap and gown on the screen. He can't eat protein. He testified here in 1997 when he was 13. Now he's a freshman at Harvey Mudd College studying to be an engineer. He would have been here today, but instead he's in the library. HMC is rated in the top five colleges in the country for the amount of time its students study during the school year. Mark is reaching for his potential because of OHSU and because of access to the medical food treatment. I'm here to discuss the historical availability of the appropriate foods and how treatment options have improved over time. When Mark was young, we received his formula through OHSU, but any other foods such as breads, noodles, baking mixes, etc., had to be purchased externally. Orders came from Canada, New York, Pennsylvania, Washington, Ohio, and even Italy. Selections were few, costs were high, and bookkeeping a nightmare. Some insurance companies paid, some did not. Frustration levels were high. Many families did not have the wherewithal to navigate the complicated procedures necessary to secure the treatment. Some kids suffered. Both the state and insurance companies ended up paying more money in medical bills. OHSU has significantly eased families' access to the necessary staples by establishing a centralized pharmacy that stocks formula and protein-free noodles, baking mixes, breads and crackers, rice, porridge, cereal, sauces, and sweets. That pharmacy and the passage of HB 2388 in 1997 have combined to help metabolic kids in Oregon reach their potential. Without these medical foods, metabolic kids would certainly become a financial drain on the state in special education classes or state-covered disabled care. If you want to see the impact of the old system, take a short trip out east out Center Street on your lunch break and talk to the patients at Salem State Hospital that have been institutionalized with PKU for over 40 years. They don't pay income taxes. Once our son gets out of graduate school, he will pay taxes. That's progress. Thank you again for your time and this opportunity to briefly explain this wonderful system that certainly has worked very well for this great state and for us. I urge your support of Senate Bill 74. Thank you.
Thank you. Jennifer.
Hello, Chairman Morissette and committee. My name is Jennifer Jones. I'm 27 years old. I am a behavioral therapist for children with autism. I'm a wife, a leader in my church, a voter, and a taxpayer. I also have a metabolic disorder called phenylketonuria, also known as PKU. I was diagnosed at birth and placed on a treatment plan since there is no cure for PKU. The treatment plan is to maintain a low phenylalanine diet using medical foods to keep phenylalanine levels at a safe range. Without treatment, the phenylalanine becomes a toxin to the body, which poisons the central nervous system and the brain. This leads to physical breakdown of the body as well as severe mental retardation. Because I was placed under treatment at birth, I developed normally and stayed within appropriate developmental stages. My childhood and teenage years were both full and active. I achieved average to above average grades. I was very involved in sports, church, drama, music, and had many wonderful friendships. More recently, in my adult life, I found myself without insurance and was unable to afford treatment for a few years. At that time, I attempted to maintain the low phenylalanine levels without using the medical foods. It was impossible. My phenylalanine levels reached an unhealthy range, and I felt the effects of it. I began experiencing extreme skin sensitivity, chronic and debilitating migraines, nausea, muscle pain, exhaustion, emotional fragility, and losses in the area of attention span and short-term memory. I have since become insured, resumed treatment using the medical foods, and have had consistently safe phenylalanine levels for just over a year. All my symptoms have decreased, and most have disappeared completely. I'm again able to live a full and active life. Medical foods are not supplements. They are necessity for treatment. The state currently mandates newborn screening for disorders such as mine. It only makes sense that they would also continue to mandate the treatment. I'm asking you to please support the passing of Senate Bill 74. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Okay, questions? Thank you. Yes.
Just one question, if I might, of Ms. Jones. Mm-hmm. Katie mentioned this, that her mother sends off her blood every week. Do you have to test your blood much like a diabetic has to test their
Yes, blood? We do a finger prick, and it's actually put on a piece of paper, the same paper they use for the newborn screening. We mail it in, and about a week later we find out what our level is.
You do that once a week?
I do it monthly, unless my levels are like out of range, and then I do it more often.
Okay, and then that time period where you were without insurance, you didn't test yourself at all?
Well, I did do some testing just to find what my levels were, but I wasn't using the medical foods at that time.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks. Ann Bedney, Corona, and Susan King, would you please come forward to testify? Oh, we may need more room. Katie, can you take care of those little kids while you're sitting there? Good job. Were you in the elevator with me when we came down? Good. Great, I know you now.
Yes, we do. Good friends. Honorable Chairman Morissette and committee members, I'm here today with my two-year-old son, Evan, to gain your support for Senate Bill 74. We are present before you because without this passage, my son would be denied effective treatment by medical insurance because of her income status. Evan was diagnosed with the metabolic disease phenylketonuria, or PKU, 6 days after birth by mandatory screening. This inherited metabolic disease makes him unable to process phenylalanine. If this disease remains unchecked, phenylalanine would accumulate in his brain, leaving him severely retarded. Evan's condition has been controlled by birth because of specific medical foods created to treat his disorder. These foods are mandatory for his growth. The lively, normal two-year-old and very tired two-year-old you see here today would not exist without these medical products. As a single mother and a full-time student, Evan in my life has had its share of challenges. One of these is financial. The cost of treatment is expensive and beyond my reach financially. I would face endless hardships in order to care for the necessary medical needs for my son. Our income status would limit the amount of treatment Evan could obtain. His needs could not be met on my own accord. Insurance coverage is the only means of protecting Evan from the reverse effects of this disease. It is my duty as a parent to protect the life of my son and to give him all the opportunities he well deserves. Please support Senate Bill 74 to protect the potential of my son's life. He and all people with metabolic diseases need to be given that opportunity. Thank you.
Thanks.
I don't want to be redundant. And so I'm not going to read through my full testimony. I did give you one like this.
Oh, yes, yes.
All I want to say is you can't really put a price on a healthy child who becomes a healthy and contributing adult. Megan is a completely normal child in every aspect except for what she eats. And this is only possible because of the medical foods that we use to rigorously monitor her diet every single day. So please support our children and our emerging adults and all the rest of us who deal with this on a daily basis, and please support Senate Bill 74.
I do have a question. As children grow older, are they able to participate in strenuous sports activities?
Yes. Megan did very well in soccer.
Okay. So
and feeding up her brother.
Metabolic food then gives them all of the supplements and nutrition and so on that they need to do everything normally.
Yes.
Good. Great. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Susan King. Is she Susan? She was.
And Mr. Chair, I noticed that Megan's smile is something similar to my granddaughter.
Yeah.
It's almost like a jack-o'-lantern.
Oh. Yeah, we, those of us who have grandchildren can see them out there. Okay, anyone else to testify? There's no one signed up, so we will then close the public hearing. Anyone else testify? Okay. There is this, the question of the sunset, and there have been some suggestions in terms of there's some possible amendments that we will deal with. This, I'm sure that this bill is going to pass. We just have to consider those before we do something right now. So we won't have a work session on it now, but we will have a work session as soon as we get that straightened out. Senator Courtney had mentioned that. The question was raised, do we need a sunset? Senator Walker raised that question a minute ago, and we would like to explore that before we take final action on the bill. So we will come back at a later time and have the work session, at which time we will simply discuss the merits of the bill, and we probably won't have another public hearing, but just the work session. So if you keep in touch with us, we'll let you
Mr.
know when
Chair.
That is. Senator Walker and then Senator Minnis.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I sent you a note. The
yes.
audience doesn't know that, but I sent him a note asking for a -2 amendment that just puts in the emergency clause and whatever else we need, but I don't think it's necessary to continue the sunset. I enjoy seeing these people here, but there is absolutely no reason why they should have to make this trek down to the Capitol every 6 years. And I see some of their testimony said in support of House Bill 2388, and they crossed it out and put in Senate Bill 74, so they've kept it in their file to bring out every 6 years. And obviously there's no cure for this disease. It's a genetic disorder, and I just see absolutely no reason that we keep going through the motions to do this.
I would agree. It does need a sunset because otherwise this bill would sunset on July 1st or 3rd or whatever, and so we have to, the new bill will have to take effect at that time. So it does need the emergency clause, which we don't have either. So that will have to be done. So there will be at least that one amendment and perhaps two amendments. So I appreciate all of you coming here today. So thank you very much.
Oh, did you forget me?
Oh, I'm sorry. Don't leave yet. Senator Minnis.
Chairman is disrespecting me.
Well, never Senator Minnis.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to have some testimony on the record from the insurance industry if they choose to oppose the deletion of the sunset. I would like to know from their perspective what the compelling reason is to maintain a sunset. mean, I generally am against mandates, but this seems to be like a no-brainer to me. So I'd like to hear what their rationale and logic is.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Fisher.
I believe the law is that mandates automatically are up in 6 years.
We are the law.
But that's what I'm saying.
We can exempt ourselves.
Are you gonna change that?
I'm gonna change it on this one.
I don't know that you can.
Yes, Senator.
Why can't we?
Simply because all insurance mandates are
only page 16 and 31 in the governor's signature.
To continue the thing for 6 more years.
Oh, Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher on line 20.
I love these free-flowing conversations.
Line 21 of this bill, it says this section is exempt from ORS 743-700, which is the mandate statute. And I know that because I have a breast cancer bill you'll be hearing hopefully in this committee that addresses that same issue. So we can just exempt it from that statute.
You get the feeling you aren't needed, Senator.
Oh, no, this is great. Yes.
Were you going to address Senator Minnick?
Well, I did see an insurance person here a little while ago, but is there...
They ran out.
John Powell was sitting here, and he's not. I don't know if he would be the one to address this
Peggy's
issue.
Peggy's out here.
Peggy? Thank you, Peggy. While she's coming up, there is one interesting experience I had similar to this. I went to a United States Supreme Court hearing one time and was listening to the two attorneys argue before the Supreme Court on what the law was, and one of the justices, as Senator Minnis did, said, "We decide that issue. We are the law."
Yeah,
so that was the Supreme Court. Yeah. But thank you for your comment. Peggy, would you identify yourself?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I represent the Health Insurance Association of America. And at least from my standpoint, we believe that the sunset review is appropriate, and we believe it's appropriate really for all mandatory services. And as I was listening to the testimony today, it struck me that that since this bill was originally enacted, this program at OHSU has expanded and become more sophisticated. And I also know that there is incredible research going on with regard to genetic issues in terms of being able to, you know, make some breakthroughs in terms of medical technology. And what we have found when we looked at the host of mandated services is that it actually is beneficial to go through this periodic review, if for no other reason than we see a couple of things. Periodically, there have been breakthroughs where there have been changes that actually have affected the language when the statute comes back up again, where for classic examples of these have been in mandate areas where there are periodic screenings, and the medical evidence has suggested changes in those kinds of procedures. And I should also say that we're not opposed to a reactment of this, but we do think it's beneficial, and I think that the information you heard in the presentation today was certainly many steps advanced of what we heard when it was really initially put in place, and I do think it is appropriate to continue these kinds of reviews, and in fact, periodically, they do represent a reason to modify the language in the statute compared to what it was initially to reflect changes that have actually occurred. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Minnis.
Peggy, are you aware of any emerging research in this particular area that would lead you to believe that this particular disease or defect or
Mr. Chair,
would be rectified by some?
Senator Morissette, Senator Minnis, no, I have not looked into that.
Your opposition to the bill, if there is opposition, would be that you don't like the fact that this is taken out of the mandatory review process.
Chair Morissette, Senator Minnis, as I said, I'm not opposed to the bill, but I do believe that having the periodic review is appropriate for the reasons that I explained. And I have not, as I said, specifically done any review or in terms of the PKU advances, but I know generally in looking at genetic issues that there are, that is the kind of breakthrough medical technology area right now. And of course, I'm not in any position at all to be able to speculate what kind of advance would occur within the next 6 years.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
If this bill did not include the six-year review, what would the position of your organization be on the bill?
Well, Senator Morissette, Senator Menace, I would continue to argue that the six-year sunset review be incorporated into the bill.
And I would suggest that that's a pretty mindless perspective on this issue.
Senator Morissette, Senator Menace, as I said, when I've looked at a whole host of mandates over a period of time, and I've collected files, and it's been surprising to me the kinds of changes that have occurred in the kind of procedures and treatments that relate to what are currently in Oregon statute. And I'd be happy to share some of that information with you.
Mr. Chairman, just for the record, I think it's asinine to bring these people before the legislature every 6 years so they have to re-argue the obvious.
Okay. Thank you, Peggy.
And okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. I would note that we've been doing, since then they institute this test in 1962.
I believe.
And there's been no medical breakthroughs since 1962.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing, and as I said, there is at least one amendment that we will need, right, for the emergency clause at least, and so we will have the work session another time. Thank you very much for being here. Okay, we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 357, and Senator Cochran, or Corcoran, and Bob Repine, please, would you come forward? Okay. We have about 45 minutes, or maybe 44, because we have to go next door. And Senator Corcoran.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I think I've just about seen every combination now on the face of the earth.
Well,
over here.
That's why they're sitting at opposite ends of the table there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I've learned in 9 years to be smart enough to bring somebody smart up with me. So that's the reason that the good Mr. Yeah. Repine is here.
Where?
Oh. He actually has expertise in this. You're going to hear some very good testimony, so I'll just make my comments very brief. I've watched this issue from a distance the entire time I've been up here, and for years before. A very close family friend in Cottage Grove has had a child on the wait list for 17 years. This is a subset, as I was talking to Mr. Repine before testimony today. Mr. Repine can give you some history on the discussions that have already taken place, and I think it will actually bring some comfort to the committee in terms of not having another task force out there per se. But one of the overlooked groups, there's a subset within the developmentally disabled community, are the people who basically didn't get the services that the state offered with regard to Fairview and with regard to the group homes. These are the people that took care of the kids at home themselves. And I just met with a group down in Cottage Grove. One of the ladies, I think the eldest one there, was 86 years old and had care of a 58-year-old son who was developmentally disabled. And they were all there with the same question in mind, which is, you know, we're not going to be able to do this forever. We need some assistance. So that's kind of what brought about the discussion with Francisco Lopez and with the other advocates of the developmentally disabled community. And that's my interest in it. And Mr. Shipwreck earlier. Mr. Repine, now I'm in trouble with both of them. Will probably, if he's not too confused right now, give you some background information. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Corcoran. Mr. Repine.
I'm confused about who I'm supposed to be at this point. Mr. Chairman, committee members, good afternoon. I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing Community Services. I told Senator Corcoran that I would give you a little background of what I know about what's going on and some personal observations that I have with this particular parenting group that have been advocating for housing for their developmentally disabled children and slash young adults. I've had the opportunity, and I say that with a great amount of pride, an opportunity to visit with them twice already this year, and I'm scheduled for three more meetings that they, as a group of advocates, have arranged throughout the Northwest in Portland to visit with like family individuals who have family members who are home with them and who are aging along with the parents and are concerned about what is the future hold for these young adults or these adults when the parents are no longer able to take care of them. So it has been a very pleasurable event for me. I've traveled to Newburgh, and I'll be going to Seaside, and there's meetings in St. Helens, and ones in Tillamook coming up, to get a little bit more background. And I think what Senator Corcoran said is correct. We at the state, in my agency, have been involved in DD housing for years, but generally you would see a great percentage of it was involved in the downsizing of Fairview, where because of federal mandates, we, the state, agreed to change from an institutional environment to more of a community environment by creating small group homes around the state to displace or relocate those clients hopefully in their communities from where they came from or where their family members are. And to date, we have over 200 of these, what they're referred to, KIPP homes in the state of Oregon, which deal with about five residential individuals on an ongoing basis. Now, having said that, the population in my time meeting with them is again a little different, a little unique in the sense that these are parents who have been taking care of their own children, committed their lives to the responsibility of the growth and nurturing of those individuals, who are seeing the aging cycle hitting them and saying, and what do I do on behalf of my child or my young adult so when I'm not here they're able to still be functional and be part of society. So I'm trying to get a lot more information of how we can facilitate this. Again, what we tried to do is, this same population, if you can imagine, there's not a lot of resources that come along with it. That's okay. We've shown them, or I've given them some examples of how housing can be accomplished with a great amount of resources that do come from my agency via the state of Oregon and the federal government programs. And unfortunately, there is, as I've told them, there are for every place I build a unit, there are multiple needs. And this group is really, with Ernest, working hard to get their hands around to grapple with the issues of housing. And I have to give them an amazing amount of credit for wanting to do that. And they've been very active, and so to appreciate that activity that they've shown me, I've pledged to them that my agency would continue working with them either on a one-to-one basis or an ongoing basis so we can start setting in place some housing opportunities that will help this population today and in the future. We all know, as we all grow old, that things change. And I don't think any one of us here today would suggest that their wish of having an opportunity for their children to be productive as they have left us, the parents, there's nothing wrong with that. And I think we would wish that for all of our children. And so this shouldn't be handled in any different way except that it's a population that really hasn't reached out quite as heftily as they have, other populations have in the past, and now we're asking for some of that assistance. There was a task force that Senator Marcet is familiar with that he and I served on with two of your other colleagues, Senator Clarno and Senator Brown, dealing with a variety of issues on housing from seniors to all people with disabilities that developed an enormous amount of information in a couple of binders that have put together, I think, some good starting premises about today's housing needs and what it holds for the next 20 years in future. Because that's what's critical, because this population, not unlike the senior population, will grow tremendously over the next 20 years. And we probably aren't prepared to deal with that growth in population vis-a-vis supplemental housing them. So we need to start thinking today, what is this going to look like in the next 20 years? So there's been a lot of work done on it. I think the task force they're advocating for makes sense. I think there's as much need in this population as there is a variety of other special populations. But to the group and to their credit, I think that they have been willing and are willing to put their shoulder down down to find answers to resolve these issues. And I respect them for that, and as an agency, we keep on working with them. How the committee works on this on a task force, I was led to believe or told earlier this afternoon that apparently in the building there might be a bill that is the continuation of this task force that the chair sat on last session. Because if you remember, it was done under an executive order. One of the recommendations of the committee was to go to the next level of discussion that we left in the report. So possibly if this task force doesn't work out or this commission doesn't work out, if the larger one is assembled, I think having a subset of populations relative to housing would be very critical so we can get this population and or other populations identified so we can start setting out a plan for the next 20 years of developing their housing needs to our ability to develop that housing as time goes by.
Okay, good. The committee that you're referring to had four representatives or four legislators instead of six, for one thing, and it was a governor's task
force. Yes, sir. It was executive order 02-010, I think.
Yeah, and now, for this task force, your department will staff.
We are, Mr. Chairman, we are referencing the bill to be a co-staffer with Department of Human Services, correct.
And the cost otherwise then would be the per diem of the... I don't remember getting a per diem for the task force that I sat on, so I don't think there was one.
Mr. Chairman, on this bill, I can't tell you, I didn't read the executive order for the other one that you served on. But on this bill, it basically says that slave people, other than legislative members, would not be reimbursed any kind of stipends. However, legislative members would be reimbursed via the Legislative Assembly budget for interim work.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, page 3, line 20, members of the task force who are not members of the Legislative Assembly are not entitled to compensation,
yeah,
but may be reimbursed for actual necessary travel and other expenses.
Okay. Okay, so do you have, well...
You're going to, Mr. Chair, you're going to get a physical, apparently, from DHS, I think around $100,000 and $40,000 from housing. Again, I guess I was just made aware of this other bill that's wending its way through. I guess my point would be whatever we can do to combine the two. I didn't know about the other bill. Anything we can do to move the cause forward and do it as cheaply as possible would be the goal rather than to not do it because of the economic straits we're in.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just again to quantify, I was only told that there was a reported bill moving through that would do this. I don't know for sure, so I don't want anybody to sit here and say, well, this gets set on the sideboard waiting for a bill that may never have been printed. I don't know. But again, for the merits of this bill, I think what they're trying to do as a group is very important, and it's a population that does need some attention.
Senator Minnis?
I've got a series of questions. The Interim Judiciary Committee did quite a bit of work on issues relevant to mental health and reentry by post-prison environments. Housing and employment were the two most critical needs of individuals who had either dual diagnosis mental health issues or persons coming out of prison for reintroduction into the community. This bill deals with developmentally disabled, but the issues are very much the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess the question would be, would you or Senator Corcoran be opposed to the expansion of this particular group to look at post-prison housing issues or mental health housing issues? Because I think we're really talking about the same potential groups to deal with the same problems. And the Senator Shields is actually here, so maybe I can kind of lead into the issue that I wanted to raise in addition to that, and that is the faith-based community isn't mentioned anywhere in the bill. And it's a custom of ours not to include faith-based organizations, religious organizations, but it is my experience in knowing many people who work in that environment that they're more than willing to help provide and facilitate these transitional services, whether it's housing, job skills, retraining, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems to me that this would be a very good tool to use to develop, I guess, a comprehensive overview of the issues of housing and even occupational issues So I'd kind of get a response back on that. I would like to see this expanded, and even if it cost us, you know, $250,000, to me it's an investment well worth our time and our energy, simply because if we're going to be successful in post-prison reentry, we're going to be successful in the mental health community or with developmentally disabled populations, we have to have an eyes wide open conscious view of what we're attempting to do here. So the bill appears to me to be somewhat constrictive in terms of the membership and the audiences, and I would just, I guess, lay those things out in front of you and see what your response is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Menace, I think your observation is correct, but I would also let you know that I think that there, for each one of those populations, including your incarcerated ex-offenders and mental health and the depopulation as this is, each one of them have their own unique characteristics. They do have things that are in common, but I would suggest to you that probably they have a lot of things that are not in common with each other. We have been working on ex-offender housing relative to what the Department of Correction trying to put some model programs into place to see what we can do. Obviously, just the characterization of ex-offender housing versus DD housing in a community brings on a whole different connotation to the community itself. So I think your idea of having the global picture is laudable, but again, I think still when you have these discussions, you've still got to break them out in very specific categories of groups, because they do have fundamentally different issues that they're trying to work through.
Mr. Chair, Senator Menace, with regard to the faith-based organizations and their involvement in this, there's no intention on my part, or I don't believe anybody else's part, in creating this bill or bringing it forward not to include those groups. I can just tell you, in Cottage Grove, ironically, the couple that I talked about that has the child on the waiting list for 17 years are devout Catholics that go to the same church as my mom, and I can tell you that Our Lady of Perpetual Help in Cottage Grove is fundamentally incapable of providing this kind of transition service. Senator Shields has at times talked to our caucus and others about faith-based organizations and the fact that we have to be cautious about trying to, you know, put on faith-based organizations, putting them in a situation that is not basically something that they're necessarily built to handle, and they end up having to construct the capacity to do that. And Senator Shields can speak to that much more eloquently than I. But I don't think there's any intention. My interest, again, was looking at a subset of the developmentally disabled that have never had their services met, and I think that I've worked in the correction system, as you know, Senator Menace, and I think Mr. Repine's absolutely right. I mean, the needs of offenders out in the community is one that creates different reactions from people, but the need is still the need. I mean, it doesn't matter whether it's welfare, you know, a woman off of welfare or a person getting out of prison, you know, jobs and housing are, and training are common needs.
We're going to have to move along.
Okay.
However, I would like to say that in Lane County we have the mother of all faith-based organizations, and that is St. Vincent de Paul. And they do this kind of work. And you fund them. Don't you?
Yes, I do.
Yes, you do.
They do excellent work.
And they do excellent work, and they do it in several different ways.
The mother of all faith-based organizations. I want you to work on that a little bit. Okay. That's a metaphor that I'm not comfortable with.
They not only give direct contributions to people, but they build houses for people, and they do an excellent job, and they're self-supporting by their entrepreneurial skills. And I was on their board for a while, and So I think that we do have that aspect of it, but I think they should be on your committee. I mean, you should have a faith-based. I don't know what the definition of faith-based is. I've always felt that we had faith-based doing this work, and maybe there's a new concept, but
it's running out of faith-based these days.
Yes.
I just want to say, I guess I would argue or take issue with your point that this DD population is distinct and different. Now, maybe we're talking about a different group, but the information provided to the Judiciary Committee is many of the folks who are finding themselves in jails and prisons are individuals with mental health problems and, in some cases, persons with developmental disabilities who are not as sophisticated in terms of interpreting commands by law enforcement or perhaps not interpreting social skills as well, and they end up in jail because we don't have facilities or housing that necessarily meets their needs. So they end up in jail, and particularly with the abolition of the asylums, the damaged state hospitals and places to put individuals with severe chronic mental illnesses, we have consciously put them in the community, and then we've consciously pulled the rug out from under them by taking all the money. And so, I mean, that's why I say we need to go into the eyes wide open. And maybe you're right for the limited purpose of this bill, but I think we ought to take a more comprehensive view of the entire picture of how we're dealing with these populations. So,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mayors, probably the reason I characterize it, particularly in this group, it's from what I've learned in the last few months from this group. Much of the population that you talked about earlier, and you are correct on people with disabilities who are incarcerated and have these overlaps of these dual issues that they're working on. I think how I've kind of become passionately involved with this group in the sense that these are parents who have raised their children to be good citizens, to not be in trouble, to do the right thing for their entire life. And the reason they're looking for housing is because the parents want to make sure that there is an opportunity for them as those parents no longer are with them. That's a quite different characteristic than somebody who has been abandoned or who has been left floating around as a homeless person who really doesn't have a care. I mean, it's this generation's will and wishes to try to do something that will sustain this type of support for the families, and then a place where families will know that when they're no longer around, there's a nice, clean, safe, affordable place for their children to live.
Mr. Chair, I think that Senator Corcoran has partially made up to Mr. Underwood, who was referred to by Mr. Repine in the 1993 session as Mr. Underwear. So,
well, you know, things can change.
Okay, with that, Francisco Lopez and Lou Ng. We have a couple of executive directors here, so who would like to start?
I can start it. By the way, I'm the Oregon Catholic Conference is sponsoring this bill, and the Archbishop is fully sponsoring the Senate bill, and we see it as important. Good afternoon. My name is Francisco Lopez, and I'm the director of the Child, Youth, and Family Integrated Services Network. It's a corporation formed by three nonprofits: Catholic Community Services of the Mid-Willamette Valley, Chehalem Youth and Family Services, and Rainbow Family Services. Those two agencies are in the Yamhill County. One of the several programs that the Integrated Services Network offers was born out of the Staley Settlement, as you are familiar with, that establishes brokerages where state services are provided with federal financial assistance through the Medicaid program. Under this new program, citizens with developmental disabilities waiting for services are assisted more quickly and are able to determine what their most immediate needs are. Currently, the ISN is operating, the Integrated Services Network is operating eight of the Oregon's counties: Marion, Benton, Clatsop, Columbia, Lincoln, Polk, Tillamook, and I have a hard time always saying Yamhill. I'm a first generation immigrant from El Salvador, so my friends here from Yamhill say, "Oh, okay," so I'm learning my way to how to say Yamhill County. Through this program, citizens make the determination of what kind of services they need. Support services brokerages are available for adults with developmental disabilities in all counties in our state. Currently, more than 1,800 adults with developmental disabilities are receiving support services from 10 different brokerages from the state. Through your support, the Staley Settlement continues recognizing that adults and children with developmental disabilities are among the most vulnerable members of our community, and our social contract obligates us to support them. One of the many successes of the support services for adults with developmental disabilities is the ability of customers, family members, circles of support, local organizations, and local county governments to provide local solutions to local problems and work towards the creation of new resources for citizens in need. Senate Bill 357 is the result of years of grassroots work conducted by local people who know their own needs better than anyone else. That's what I'm here today, to speak in support of Senate Bill 357, sponsored in the Senate by Senator Tony Corcoran, but it's also a House Bill, 2889, sponsored by State Representative Billy Dauto and 10 other legislators in the House. This bill is currently receiving bipartisan support, and rightly so. One of the many problems facing our customers is the need for affordable housing. The private housing available for these citizens in Oregon tends to be substandard and in many cases expensive. We estimate that more than 40% of Oregon's household pay rent that is not affordable. And I'm talking about adults with disabilities, developmental disabilities. Let me give you one example of what we mean by an affordable. An adult with a developmental disability earning the Oregon minimum wage has to work 59 hours per week to have an income high enough to afford $500 a month to pay rent. This calculation says that the person will spend no more than 30% of his or her income on rent. This according to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. What is clear to us is that the steps should be taken to help adults with developmental disabilities to find solutions to their housing needs. Some sources estimate that there are more than 59,000 Oregonians who have a developmental disability. This represents a considerable number of citizens. I believe that Senate Bill 357 will address and work towards a solution to the housing crisis for adults with developmental disabilities and their families. What is the solution? From my job, I have found that Oregonians with developmental disabilities, their families, circles of support, and community organizations and advocacy groups and housing authorities have different views about a sustainable solution to the need of a housing affordability for this particular population. Some families believe that semi-independent living programs might be the solution. Some others believe in residential housing programs with some level of support. Some others believe in multifamily housing programs. And many others believe in a total independent housing program. What is certain is that we don't know how we can access those federal dollars or some assistance to build affordable housing. You know, the task force the Senate Bill 357 will help local communities understand the complexities of accessing of housing funds, and will also help us to develop a comprehensive approach in order to solve the growing housing problems for our population. We know that this task force will tailor a solution with which all of us can agree for the next legislative session. This task force will provide a point of reference for the next legislative session, similar to the Farm Worker Housing Interim Task Force, as many of you remember, that was chaired by State Representative Kenan Mannix and Senator Susan Castillo in 1999. That particular task force gave us the state some solutions that were implemented during the 2001 legislative session. The big lesson from the task force was that affordable housing is not just the responsibility of one sector of our community, but instead requires an effort by all segments of our society, including government. Today you will listen to the experts in the area of affordable housing for adults with developmental disabilities, but the most important part of this hearing is the stories of self-advocates and parents that you're going to hear. They know the importance of addressing this crisis. This is their issue because it comes from their story. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
My name's Lou. Can you hear me?
Yes.
And I'm the executive director of Mainstream Housing. And Mainstream started 13 years ago working collaboratively with the Mental Health DD Services Division to improve the design of the 5-bed KIPP group homes that they were building to facilitate the downsizing and the eventual closure of Fairview State Hospital. So Mainstream developed 32 of those, and now we own and operate 32 of the KIPP 5-bed group homes. Either 2 or 3 years ago when Fairview closed, we diversified our funding base and our the types of projects we do, and now we have 3 multifamily projects in the pipeline, a new development project up in Gresham, and 2 acquisition rehab projects in Eugene Springfield. And we're finding that the overriding issue for people with developmental disabilities that live in the community, the overriding housing issue, is poverty. Francisco was mentioning some wage scales for minimum wage. Most of the people with developmental disabilities that live in our projects depend on Social Security incomes of about $580 a month. And HUD says that to be affordable, someone shouldn't be paying more than about a third of their total income on housing. That means we need to get deep enough subsidies into these projects to keep the rents down around $200 a month for most of our renters. St. Vincent de Paul's was mentioned. Ann Williams, who's their housing developer, is my board president now. I knew that we needed to get some really experienced developers on our board when we diversified away from group homes. She's very good, and she's one of my best mentors. And even St. Vincent de Paul's has a really hard time keeping the rents down affordable to people that are on SSI incomes, which are about 24% of median. Most nonprofit housing developers, the majority of their housing ends up being for renters that have incomes at 50 or 60% of median, just because it's hard to get enough subsidy in there. You have to carry almost no loan on a property because you still have to pay for property management and upkeep. So affordability is the overriding issue. Another issue is support services. The types of supports that people with developmental disabilities need vary greatly. They can be 24-hour care. It can be a few hours of support a week in their own apartment. It can be foster care. It can be a few hours a day. It varies so much. And with the varied levels of services, we need to develop various models of housing to go along with that. Right now in the state, we have group homes, we have foster care, we have people living in the community and getting support services in their apartments, but even those folks usually end up paying more than a third of their income towards their rent when they're renting in the community. Then we've got folks, as has been mentioned earlier, that are living in their parents' home, and a lot of parents are aging. And then we've got folks living in the community with disabilities that are in substandard housing and don't have enough support services. And the reason I support this bill, Senate Bill 357, is because I don't know how many people in the community have developmental disabilities and are paying more than they should out of their SSI incomes. I don't know how many of them are living with their parents who are aging out of being able to take care of them, or how many of them are living in the community and paying more than they should, or are living in substandard housing. It makes it very hard to plan for what you're going to do in the future as a nonprofit and work with other agencies in doing that. I would like to know more so we can create a plan and develop various types of housing models to match the various needs, and hopefully models that will leverage dollars from HUD, the Federal Home Loan Bank, foundations, and bring more dollars into the state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. We have about 13 more minutes. We do have another committee meeting that I have to go to at 3, and Senator Starr. And we do have a number of people who would like to testify. Carol McLeod, Angie Keim, Bob Smith. And if you could keep your testimony fairly brief, that would be helpful. Now, let me just say that there's some question about where this bill is going to go. At the request of the president, we have a referral to Ways and Means from this committee. Is that correct?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, this bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, as does the bill sponsored by Representative Greenleck and Representative Dalto, House Bill 2889. Also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Well, often though, we pass it to the floor first and then Ways and Means. You're saying this goes to Ways and Means from here. Okay, so this will go from this committee to Ways and Means.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Chairman and Senators, thank you for your time today. I appreciate you allowing me to speak. My name is Carol McLeod, and I come with two hats on. My first hat is a parent. I have a 23-year-old son, Jay, who's at work today, which I'm really grateful, because when you hear about that low income, he makes $230 a month. But it's probably the highlight of his day when he heads off to work each day. Mind you, I typically drive him to work because transportation is also an issue, which means that's what I use my lunch period for every day. High school was great. He's a great community member. He's recognized in our home community of Newburgh. He's even been on the newspaper, on the front page of the newspaper. But when he graduated from high school, I hit that point that you hear folks talking about. What's next in Jay's life? How do I, as a parent, move him from being a successful child, a successful student, to being a successful adult? Because even Jay, with developmental disabilities, really wants to be a successful adult. And I think when I looked at it and when the county did an assessment with about 100 families in Yamhill County, housing seemed to be the central issue on moving our children to becoming capable adults in their home communities.
Good.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is really important. It's important for their own self-worth, and it also helps me realize that I'm doing my job as a parent and preparing my child to be an adult and face the fact that I'm not going to be there forever. And so that's why I got involved in Fulfill and ended up as the board chairperson, and probably my face is a little red right now because I'm not used to talking to groups like this. But we developed our organization, Families United for Independent Living, to advocate for the development of safe, affordable, sustainable housing. I think you hear lots of programs start, and you have parent groups all over the state trying to do housing for their adults with developmental disability, but sustainable is really the key. I think you heard Lou Enge speak very well to the fact that the income level is not there. We're below the poverty level. So those are pieces that are really important to us. I think we view this task force as a starting point to continue pulling those pieces together, the Oregon Housing and Community Services, the forums they're doing in the different counties, working with Housing Authority, working with the state to bring in federal grant monies to help build homes, and then working with such things as the brokerage firms through the Staley lawsuits to develop supports around these individuals so that they can be participating community members. Because my son Jay is probably one of the few people in the state that was happy, that was actually very happy that he paid taxes. He thought that was cool that he had to pay state taxes. He likes being a contributing member of his community. It's really important to him. Mm-hmm. So I would hope that you would support the development of something like this. I think it's needed. We need to, as a state, look comprehensively so we don't have all these little pockets of development happening, that that all communities can look forward to something like this.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we have time for two more speakers, and then we're going to refer this, hopefully, to Ways and Means, and we have to then go to another committee.
I'm Angie Keim. I'm 28 years old. And I live with my parents in a rural home in McMinnville, Oregon. When I was 16, I was put on a wait list because of the shortage of safe, affordable housing. And because my parents are still able to provide a home for me. 12 years later, I'm still waiting. At one time, I was content. Now I have a dream of a place of my own. My own furniture, linens, dishes, groceries, all the things many of you take for granted, I dream of having. My disability isn't as severe as some. With support and affordable housing, my dream can become reality. I want to live in my community as an individual. Walk among my peers, have my own address, and my own mailbox. I want to control parts of my life that I can have and help when I need it, where I need it. I want to be safe. I don't want to be taken advantage of. Because I don't drive, I need housing that's located in the core or area of town. I want to work. I want to be the best that I can be, but I need help. I participate in Special Olympics. Through this experience, I have learned that the strong need to help the weak, and that all people have value. When we work together, we can do great things. I can add value to my community. My parents, along with 14 other families, formed Families United for Independent Living to work for affordable housing for adults with developmental disabilities. Because there are so many people like me and so few affordable housing opportunities. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, my name is Bob Smith. I live in Newburgh. I'm the parent of a 33-year-old daughter with developmental disabilities. I'm also on the Board of Directors of Families United for Independent Living and also the Yamhill Community Development Corporation. Since there were no housing options available when Kristen was ready to live more independently, my wife and I purchased a 4-bedroom, 2-bath home and started a licensed adult foster care home for her and two other developmentally delayed women. A retired teacher friend volunteered to be their companion for a very modest salary. We had hoped this could be a long-term home for Kristen. Now, with 8.5 years of experience, we know it is not sustainable after we are gone. There's too much work that we do and participation in it. This population's income from SSI supported employment and Section 8 housing vouchers is not sufficient to support a debt service, property management, food, and the necessary living supports. These younger adults do not have the benefit of retirement savings, funds from selling a home to help them pay for assisted living facilities or long-term care, as many seniors do. You know, as people have talked, they're basically destitute. The waiting lists for supported housing are so long now that usually the parents have to die before it becomes a crisis and someone's name gets moved to the top of the list. At that point, when it's a crisis, there is state funding available and the folks are moved into a group home, maybe in their own community like us in Newburgh, or it could be in Klamath Falls. There's no guarantee for it. Families United was founded by parents to provide safe, affordable, and appropriate housing in their own community with a support system in place to allow a successful and sustainable independent life. Creation of this type of housing has been done using funds from Oregon Housing Community Services, Housing Urban Developments, and other grant money, but the process is almost impossible for us non-professionals. Since a potential for profit is not available, the developers of assisted living facilities and long-term care facilities are really not interested in this population. We hope this task force of concerned, knowledgeable people could pave the way for organizations such as Families United to provide affordable housing for this large and growing population. I know with the current budget problems in Oregon, there will not be a large amount of money available. However, with added awareness of the needs and more technical assistance, Families United for Independent Living and other nonprofit groups can make these come true using currently available resources. You know, we're not up here because we're political people. We're here out of necessity. Our daughter's 33, and no one has ever stepped forward and saying, pack Kristen's bags, there's a great place for her to live. It's just not available. And the other groups, whether it's the coming out of prison or the farm workers or the seniors, have much stronger lobbies than what we have had through the years, and we've been left out. And with Francisco's help and Bob Repine's great assistance here now, we're becoming a little more visible, and we're really looking for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience to speak against this issue? Okay. We're going to lose people now because we have other hearings that start at 3, and so what I hope is that we can move this to the Ways and Means Committee for their hearing, because that's where it's going to end up anyway, because there is a fiscal cost to it. So are we ready for a motion? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing, open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Move Senate Bill 357 to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, it's been moved.
And with a due pass recommendation.
With a due pass recommendation, 357 to Ways and Means, with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing no discussion, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Bennett?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator
Fisher? Aye.
Senator Aye. Okay. Thank you, and the meeting is adjourned. Ma'am, I'm... Could